Hi everyone, and welcome to the Associate and Affiliate Cricket Podcast. We have a very big show this week, talking about the Asian Cricket Council's T20 Championship. And to do that with me, I have, as usual, Andrew Nixon. Hi Andrew.
Hi Russ, hi everybody.
Well, start with some news though. There's a few things happening in the Associate Cricket world this week. Andrew, John Rooney caused some controversy in Ireland.
Yes, indeed he did. He, as many people will know, former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher died this week, and John Mooney put out a tweet, which I don't think we'll repeat here, which has caused some controversy, put out a number of tweets, in fact, and all hell broke loose, especially in the Northern Ireland cricket community, who found this, what he was saying on Twitter, to be sort of grossly offensive. And there have been Cricket Ireland first have distanced themselves from what he said, and have said that disciplinary action is being considered. There's calls coming for him to never play for Ireland again, and people saying that they'll never watch an Ireland game with him in the side, and it's all a big mess, really. It's sort of got the attention of the national media in the UK. It's been on the BBC website. It's been in the Sun, the Daily Mirror, the Daily Mail, several other UK newspapers. And it's going to be tricky for Cricket Ireland to get out of this and look good at the same time.
It's interesting. They're in an interesting position, obviously, Cricket Ireland, because they are a sport that covers both the north and the south of Ireland, and also a sport that is perceived as a very English sport, and so obviously Thatcher's role within the Troubles isn't something you necessarily want to bring up within that context for them.
No, absolutely not. And in general, in the north as well, it's a game played on both sides of the community, so the Protestant and the Catholic community. So an incident like this tends not to go down very well. As I said, people are saying they won't go to games again if he's in the team. So, and in general, it's an indication of just how high a profile cricket in Ireland has now. Had this had happened 10 years ago, it's arguable that this would never have even been reported on in the UK media. But because Irish cricket now has such a high profile, it gets this sort of response.
Also, in news that came out, I think yesterday, the city of Lauderhill, which is obviously the host to stadium in the United States, sent a letter to the ICC stating that they'll need to potentially reposition the facility away from cricket because of USACA's not sanctioning matches there and because of the costs. Your thoughts on this, Andrew?
I'm not entirely surprised by it. There's long been some disquiet within the cricket community in the US that the facility costs too much to run events at, and even obviously the events that are being run there aren't bringing in the revenue that is needed. If anybody who watched the live streaming of the OT Cup games in November will have seen completely deserted stadium, and I don't know what the crowds were like for the Americas Division 1 tour, but I imagine they were also deserted. They've obviously brought in that big crowd for the New Zealand West Indies series last year, but the previous New Zealand v Sri Lanka series didn't have a good crowd. So it's not surprising. It's hard to keep a facility of that size and quality. And it is a good ground. It's better than some grounds in Test playing nations. It's hard to keep it going. So it's not entirely surprising. It's disappointing. I think the mayor of Lauderhill, Richard Kaplan, is quite scathing of USACA in his letter to David Richardson. He refers to a long sordid history of suspensions and poor governance, which I think is putting it mildly. So it's disappointing, but not entirely surprising.
I had heard as well that the costs were outrageous on that. And do you think the ICC is actually likely to sanction things outside of USACA, which is more or less what they are?
You'd hope they would, but the ICC seem to be absolutely hell-bent on sticking with USACA, no matter what. So, they've already been suspended twice. They've come close to being suspended a couple of other times since, and yet the ICC still stick with them. You kind of sort of hope that the IC would do something without USACA's sanctioning, but history suggests that they won't.
The WCL 7 has almost finished. I believe the final's being played as we speak. Vanuatu have won, I think, their 12th straight WCL game and qualified along with Nigeria. And we'll have a chat about this next week. The final day was particularly exciting as Fiji lost out on net run rate after falling only 5 runs short against Botswana.
Yeah, very unlucky for Fiji. Nigeria played superbly on that final day, scoring more than 300 in their game against Germany. So I think it's thoroughly deserved for them, and a good recovery after a disappointing African T20 tournament.
New Zealand and Namibia this week, that they're having ongoing issues because of their sponsor complaining about the lack of black players in the side and requesting quotas, and that they've declared a persona non grata to journalist Carlos Kambwaka because of his negative reporting on Namibian cricket. Some odd things going on there.
Absolutely. It's sort of reminiscent of certain people within USACA trying to ban Peter Della Penna, who we had on last week. And this quarter thing is something that South Africa went through sort of in the 1990s and early part of this century. And there's long been sort of concerns over the development of black players within Namibia. And they are there, but they're just not making the team. I think it becomes especially annoying when Namibia start picking South Africans with Namibian passports ahead of the locally produced black players. I think in one point, actually, one of the black players who played for them recently was a black South African. So they're even when it comes to the black players, they're picking South Africans ahead of the locally produced players. So it's disappointing, and to some extent, nobody likes to have a quota system. You know, you always want sides to be selected on merit, but obviously, like South Africa had, Namibia has had an apartheid past. It used to be part of South Africa, of course. So there is that transformation that needs to take place, and as ugly as a quota system may seem, it has to be done. And if your sponsors are saying, well, you need to sort this out, then it's, you know, imperative that Cricket Namibia sort it out. They really need to ensure that they don't lose the sponsorship. They're not a high performance program country. I think there's a good chance that they will become one in the near future. So without that additional funding, they need every penny they can get from the sponsors.
Yeah, I believe too, the particular incident that caused this was an under-19 match. So it wasn't even necessarily one of those matches where they really need to win. Under-19, I mean, it's important, but it's also a developmental process, and that's that sort of place where you want to bring in a certain number of black players. So it was a strange decision by them to choose under-19 South Africans and then kind of backtrack from it. Hopefully they can sort this out. They're a very promising country. They've got a lot of young players coming through. So this is the sort of thing they need to fix up.
Yeah, absolutely. The last thing they want to do is to lose a sponsor who's been with them for quite some time.
Moving on to the interview section of the show now. We've recorded several during the week, and beginning with Somesh Verma, the editor of Cricket Nepal and a writer for the Kathmandu Post.
Welcome, Somesh.
Thank you.
Somesh, let's start with the Asian Cricket Council's T20 Championship. Nepal did very well. They made the final. Which players in particular impressed you in that tournament?
A few players really impressed me this time around were Sharad B. Farker and Kevin Mala. And we know that these players have these players didn't look very concerned, despite having a technique and ability to go through. They used to be in that quarter as doing, and I thought that they would play really well in one match and fizzle out in the other. The difference was this time we looked more positive. This was a nice thing to see. And eventually, they scored pretty well. We know that the main star for Nepali batting was Captain Paras Harka, but I'm not surprised with his batting because last couple of years, he's been the heaviest scorer for us. So that part was not surprising. Sharad Deshwakar and Kendall Rahola, whom we know he had this time around, they proved it. So these players impressed the most.
What about in some of the opposition? Does any particular player stand out from those teams?
Opposition was pretty good to have won, except for a few matches. I was a little surprised with the team from UAE. We always regarded UAE as a little better than the Nepal team. They were 10% better. The way Nepal beat them, that's only fine. Despite UAE having beaten Afghanistan earlier on, that was surprising because I thought UAE probably didn't apply themselves properly. I wouldn't say that they were under crowd pressure. Crowd pressure was huge, I understand, but UAE players are seasoned players, at least in this level, and I was a little surprised because at crucial points, we saw that we were faltering when it came to fielding, when it came to batting. And then that was surprising. Other than that, I'm not surprised much because Malaysia were always a match for us. And Singapore, we've beaten them in the past. Even Malaysia, we've beaten them in the past. That was not surprising. Yes, UAE was a little surprised. Not in a very good way.
One of the other important things that came out of the tournament is that the crowds were, again, very big. And they're also much better behaved than in the past. Are there any particular reasons for this?
Yes, it was pretty interesting. The way crowds behaved during the entire tournament, we could see that never more played. Crowd was full house. And we don't have a very good track record as far as crowd behavior is concerned, especially when we're losing. But this time around, the good part was we had about 2 matches, except for Hong Kong. And in the final, of course. But one of the reasons that our behavior was good was also because I would say how did also learn cricket. So we know that their team is doing their best. And even if they're lost, you don't blame the team entirely. And if they're less the other reason is security point of view, cricket association of Nepal, cricket point of view. The security was off, and we had a number of policemen in state clubs in the crowd itself, so that we could manage this out. The other thing is, even when Nepal lost fight, it was not a one-sided match where the team was crushed entirely. So, I think crowd has learned to appreciate the team, and they have known that we do our best, and they are doing their best. So lost doesn't really matter. And the other point I want to make is, in the past 1 year, Nepal's performance at association has been really good. When it comes to World T20 qualifiers, we finished 7th. Despite starting the tournament at the 16th place, we finished at 7th. So that was remarkable to do in ICC in the World Cricket League in Division 4. We won the tournament, which was being good for the senior team. There are even ICC Trophy in deep, and when we spread the documents with you. So I think that the leaders were started, but we probably didn't. We came in with a variety of the crowd has started building in that team. So there's less frustration in the crowd. And of course, the security point of view becomes important. This time around, there are enough people, even in social media, there are a lot of people saying that, so what? If they all play well, we are happy. So that's
you mentioned there that the Bulls improved their performance quite significantly in the last couple of years with their good results. What do you put that down to?
Last couple of years. I think let's talk about a decade ago when we had Roy Pass, the former Sri Lankan test player, as our coach. He had to build a team and then teach youngsters the basic of cricket. We didn't have a very good structure early on. When we came here, we started building the team. When we're building a team, we're likely to lose a lot of matches. We focus is on improving the standard of the game, and we don't expect right results right away. He went in almost 2 years ago, he left the team. Then we have a new coach now, who the analysis, he pushed the entire test level, he's taken them to World Cup. He became performance coach. So the good part is the talent that we have grown. Now he has translated Sam to perform. So we see Nepali players are much more confident when it comes to play. Whenever they come into the field, you see the difference. They're much more confident about themselves, and they know they are there. They have to perform their best. So the opposition has been weak in these couple of years. They are performing, but that's what the different point I would see. Because they have much more inherent things to have on you. And that has translated this out.
The team itself is it a professional standard? Is it professional at the moment? Are the players getting paid? And how's their relationship with the association?
They are getting paid. But we can't do it for the country as professional cricketers. I would say professional and their charts. And it would be after on professional. On match. And they also get a monkey. So, again, it's providing money, but really, it's not good enough for tennis teams, I would say. So, we have cricketers who are not lasting cricket to earn their investment. But, basically, they're getting some money. There's another thing that some of the players have started even in professionally as well. We gave an example of Paras Kankar, who beat the Canadian League last year as a professional player. A couple of players from the team also went and played in Sri Lanka in the domestic tournament. What it has done is it has given hope for the players who are young. They think that we can make money. So that has changed for the players. But as of now, we can't share that.
Moving on then to the future, the World Cricket League 3 is coming up quite soon. How do you think Nepal will go in that tournament? Who do you expect to do well?
I expect Nepal to do very well, also because I'm Nepali. That's one reason. If you look at the teams that are playing in World Cricket League Division 3, Uganda, Bermuda, Oman, Italy, the United States, and Nepal. We seem to be fair games. I would say the United States and Bermuda are the strong teams, apart from the club. We would have to work hard against them. Not easy to Uganda, Oman, and Italy easily. And especially because it's a limited over tournament. Anything can happen on a given day. It's not like that's much where, you have 5 days even to recover. So, the college at least, speaking. They'll have to perform the best.
And your expectations for the next couple of years? Can Nepal challenge for a World Cup, potentially, or at least the I Cup and the high performance program?
It's too early to talk about World Cup, I would say. It's always about taking performance from one tournament to another and performing at your best and then getting into another level. As far as everything from World Cricket League Division 3, I think Nepal has the capability. If you look at our batsmen and the bowlers, and feeling has improved off heat. We had a fairly good feeling side, feeling has improved. So we have a chance to move into high performance league. But again, United States and Bermuda, because Bermuda has an issue of cricket, and it has also played at the World Cup. In the United States and Nepal, it's difficult to pick between them. They're fairly competitive sides, but then again, there would be one confidence that Nepal will take because we've beaten them in past and recent past. So that confidence is likely to work. So I would say World Cup is a far cry as of now. But then we have every opportunity and we have the capability to get into the next level.
Thank you, Sumesh.
Thank you, Russ.
Last week saw the publication of the 150th edition of the Wisden Cricketers' Almanac. Being an aficionado of cricket outside the Test Play Nations, the first section I always turn to is the Cricket Around the World section, which, as its name suggests, covers cricket all around the world. Speaking to me about this section now is Almanac Assistant Editor James Coyne. Thanks for coming on the show, James.
Thank you for having me, Andrew.
Okay, we'll start with, can you tell us a bit about the history of the Round the World section?
Yeah, absolutely. it was instituted in 1993. Matthew Engel was the editor of Wisden. It was his first edition as editor. And I think he decided for a number of reasons that it would be a good section to bring in. I think he probably had he's a Guardian man for a start, and I think he felt that, you know, there was a sort of a global necessity to spread the game of cricket. And there were a lot of stories, I think, that hadn't been told from unusual parts of the cricket-playing world for a number of reasons. I guess it was first spread by the British, but then in the 80s and the 90s, with the emigration of a lot of people from the subcontinent, I think there was a sort of another wave of cricket playing that was starting to happen in countries that you really wouldn't expect at all. So I think there was this sort of imperative to tell that story. And also there were some very entertaining stories to tell as well.
Moving on to sort of this year's section, how many countries does it cover?
Oh, this year, let me have a look. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. It's about 15 this year, maybe slightly more than that.
Right.
Yeah, about 15 or 16, I think. We have a pretty good geographical spread as well.
Yeah. And is that sort of several major nations, and you have little bits on all the other nations as well? I know that's what you've done in past years.
Yeah, shall I tell you the countries we had this year?
Yeah, go ahead.
We have Andorra, Bulgaria, Cambodia, China, France, Germany, Guatemala, Liberia, Maldives, Mongolia, New Caledonia, Oman. New Caledonia is a French department. Oman, Poland, Romania, St. Helena, Spain, Tajikistan, and the USA. And there's two other features as well. One by Barney Douglas of the ECB, who's doing a film on Kenya's Maasai cricketers.
Yeah.
And there's a sort of a page on that. He's bringing out a film later this year. And I've done a feature on cricket on Eurosport on the 2020 tournaments they cover. So there's actually probably about 20 articles in there this year, which makes it one of the bigger ones we've had, actually.
That's fantastic. So do you have sort of local contributors within each of those countries, or is it information that people have sourced sort of from the internet or whatever?
Well, it's a mixture. It's a mixture. I think when it first started, Cricket Around the World, I'm sure your listeners will love the idea of it, but it was really dependent on, this was slightly before email, mm-hmm. or it was in the very formative days of email, so there was a lot of faxing going on to various corners of the globe, and members of cricket boards in the Dominican Republic or Iran or that sort of thing. And it's changed since then. I mean, I guess a lot of people are living in those countries or visit those countries and get in touch with the cricket playing authorities. Like Fabian Muir is an Australian who lives in Berlin, and he'd written an article for us on Germany this year. And same with Chris Simpson, who's a BBC reporter. He has written a piece on Liberia. But then again, there are those like Neil Godden, who's a coach in New Caledonia. And he's sort of involved in the actual coaching of cricket there. So there's a mixture. It's a real mixture of people.
Mm-hmm. Think about, since the section started in 93, you said,
mm-hmm.
I think the number of ICC members has more than doubled. Mm-hmm. There's now many more tournaments taking place, but at the same time, some modern technology, you said, is making it easier to actually get this information. So is it now easier or harder to put the section together?
I would say it's probably, I would have to say it's easier. I mean, there's, with a lot of these countries, there's the sort of the history of the game that's told in Roy Morgan's Encyclopedia of World Cricket,
mm-hmm.
There was a wonderful Barclays World of Cricket. I'm not sure if you've seen that, but it's a huge green book that was brought out, I think, in the early 80s. I think it was updated a number of times as well. And there's sort of a lot of histories of the more established world nations like Argentina and that sort of mm-hmm. thing. So you have the sort of encyclopedic element of it, and yet you also have people that are blogging and travel logging from there now. So yes, it is a lot easier, and the breadth of material is probably greater, I think.
So as well as these sort of sections on the individual countries, do you also cover things like the Intercontinental Cup and World Cricket League?
We do. We actually didn't cover the World Cricket League last year, and we got a bit of flack for that. Mm-hmm. And it was for reasons of space more than anything else. But we've returned it this year. We have a sort of a half page just round up of World Cricket League, and then we've always carried, even last year we carried the results from all the World Cricket League and the regional 2020 tournaments. Mm-hmm. And the Intercontinental Cup, we have about two or three pages on that as well. So they're in quite close proximity to cricket around the world, so it's quite easy to sort of flick through and sort of flick between the two. So yeah, we do cover them all.
So cricket in sort of these nations has probably never had as high a profile as it currently does. Matches mm-hmm. get live streamed. Last year there was live streaming in from Estonia.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's more websites covering the game at this level. Do you think Wisden still has a role to play in informing people about the game in these countries?
I think it's a very valid point. I think I suppose in 93 when Matthew started it, there was probably a real opportunity there for Wisden to do something quite different. Mm-hmm. And I think what we try and do is we try and make these stories as entertaining as possible. That's not to say there's a lot of terrific writing on global cricket, and there is, but I think we try and make them as vivid as possible. That's what we try to do. There's a real sort of breadth in the coverage that we try to capture. We try and make them entertaining, these stories. We try and make them informative. And at the same time, in certain countries, there's a real imperative to, as Cricket Europe does so very well, to really question why certain countries like the USA haven't progressed as the way they should have done. Uh-huh. So there's a mixture that we try and capture. You know, the great good luck stories like Afghanistan, I shouldn't say luck so much, but the great news stories like Afghanistan and Kenya and Maasai cricketers and New Caledonian players, set against the more serious sort of focus on why cricket hasn't taken off in certain countries. So whether that makes us stand out from others, I'll leave that for others to judge, but that's what we try to capture.
Right, so I think about that just about to wraps it up. So we'd say the Almanac is available now in all good bookshops and online at wisden.com.
Yeah, so there's a shorter Wisden, which is an ebook. So if as I suppose many of your listeners don't live in the UK, that's a good option for you. And Cricket Around the World is in its entirety in that shorter Wisden ebook. And Wisden Cricket's Almanac is available from the website to buy. And yeah, and Cricket Around the World is in there as well. So.
Okay, well, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Our third and final guest this week is Shreya Khan, the media manager for the Asian Cricket Council, to tell us more about the region and the recent championships. Shreya, welcome on the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We'll start with the Asian Cricket Council's T20 tournament. What were your thoughts on that? Which players impressed you in that tournament?
I think the two players of the tournament who impressed all of us and were Waqas Barkat of Hong Kong, the young wicketkeeper batsman, and Irfan Ahmed, the all-round who's quite familiar to followers of Associate Cricket. Irfan himself has put on a terrific amount of pace. He's always been one of those promising fast bowlers who bowled the occasional super fast ball. But now he's consistently up there in the 80s, even touching 85 throughout every ball of the over. And that's just come about as a result of some hard work with the coaches. And as I asked the coaches, Rumo Shripnayake, our development officer, the former strike and fast bowler, who's been, you know, working in Hong Kong for the past 6 or 7 years, why it took Irfan so long to become established. He just said that's the difference between test cricketers and associate cricketers. It took Irfan 5 years to literally time his release point correctly. If he'd had 2 or 3 months, you know, solid work with, you know, absolutely spot-on coaching, he'd have got that, you know, a lot earlier. So Irfan's just coming good now. He's in his mid-20s, and we can expect good things from him for the next, as long as he keeps on playing. And Waqas, really impressed. He was batsing the tournament, made 280 runs in 6 innings, including the tournament's solitary 100. Waqas came in against Nepal. You know, can you imagine 15,000 to 20,000 people in the crowd baying for his blood, and started stroking the ball around and just quieting the crowd within minutes. He really is a class player, and pressure seems to bring out the best in him. So both of you deserved all the tributes that came their way. And For Nepal, obviously, Paras Khadka impressed his leadership. He plays some pressure innings, led from the front. As a bowler, I think he's not quite the same pace bowler he was. He certainly bowls off-spin occasionally in limited overs cricket. But Paras impressed. And for Afghanistan, I thought Gulbuddin Naib just confirmed his immense talent. The young all-rounder, he often comes in first change and comes in a little late, I think, in their batting lineup. Normally about 6 or 7. Certainly could do with coming in earlier, but he's class. And Nabi just, Nabi's always been fabulous. Nothing, no surprises there. But yeah, those 4 or 5 cricketers really stood out.
It must be very pleasing, actually, from the development point of view, to have so many young cricketers performing so well at tournaments like this, throughout the region, really.
Yeah, when you say young, Russell, these cricketers are people who've been around 3 or 4 years, and they announce themselves as saying players of talent, and they don't quite push on as much as, we'd like them to. As I said, you reach a player like Irfan who says, my God, that guy's got potential. And yet he doesn't quite get to that next level. But I think now with, the systems that are coming into place and a greater awareness from the coaches who are working with these players of, what they can do and what they should be doing. The science of coaching has just come on leaps and bounds in the past few years with, so many electronic aids or video analysis that, coaching is improved. And I think it shows in the performance of the players.
On the other side of the ledger, Singapore got relegated, I think. They really struggled. Was that a surprise?
Singapore, in our T20, there's no relegation from that level. What happens, the participants are determined by the 50-over cricket. So that determines who plays. The top 10 of the 50 overs play the 20-over T20, which is the pre-World Cup qualifier for the ICC World Cup, World T20. Singapore, I think what happens, Russell and Andrew, as you well know, globally, these cricketers are amateurs who give their time to cricket after they finish their work duties from 9 till 5, or in the Middle East case of like 9 till 7 or 8. And Singapore, Maldives played very well to beat them, but Maldives just did what any side batting in a T20 should do. They batted aggressively, and they put the ball in the right areas, and Singapore just, didn't win that day. That was the one game they thought they should have won. They didn't. And of course, everyone else was even stronger than Maldives. So Singapore struggled. But they have a event in August, which you may know about, against the Pakistan Under-23, India Under-23, Sri Lankan Bangladesh Under-23s, along with Afghanistan's national team, Nepal's and UAE's, in Singapore. I think they'll be, better prepared for that one.
The other notable fact of the tournament was the crowds were immense, but also a little bit better behaved than in the past. That must be pleasing, since I think Nepal was threatened with not having more tournaments if that didn't improve.
Yeah, I mean, the crowds in Nepal always has had great numbers, even for, youth team tournaments, under-15s, under-16s, all the way up after senior level. Even women get a good crowd. The thing is, in terms of the crowd, it's an Asian phenomenon. There, the seats aren't numbered. There's no kind of tracing back or video cameras on the crowd themselves, as there are in English football matches. So one can't say they're terribly badly behaved. Just that they get boisterous and things have been thrown and matches maybe have been influenced in the past to the detriment of teams playing against Nepal. This time the Cricket Association drafted in, I think, paramilitary troops, riot police, I think in their thousands, in full armored gear to keep control. And this time there was a step of actually selling tickets. Everyone who paid actually, had to, in a way, be known to the people who sold them tickets to. So there wasn't, any hint of any violence or any disruption. And, the noise levels were fantastic, and they really get behind their crowd. And they're not quite at the level of applauding opposition's quality play, but I think they're not far away because the knowledge of cricket in Nepal is certainly increasing. And they're appreciating the benefits, they're appreciating the finer points of the game.
it's been good to have TV coverage. I think both Afghanistan and Nepal had the final on their local TV. So do you expect that to continue at further ACC events? Not just in those two countries, but maybe further afield as well?
Yeah, I mean, there's a basic cost, of course, for television coverage, whether you're filming Sachin Tendulkar batting or Paris Kapka batting. There is a basic cost of cameras, cameramen, uplinks, satellites, all those things. You know, it's one of those things which I know the ICC and even, you know, we've had it before. We've had radio commentary via the internet at our tournaments. It's feasible. As a development body, we're just at the level where spending $100,000, for example, on this, as opposed to $100,000 on bats and balls, you know, coaching, etc., is one of those marginal calls which just tipped in the balance of putting bats and balls in, you know, new cricketers' hands at the moment. But I'm sure it's going to change. And in terms of getting television, is in Nepal it's easy. The cricket's on the front and back page of the news. Nepal Television have committed cricket lovers in their production team. In the UAE or Singapore or Malaysia, it's not so easy to have that kind of access to, you know, facilities and production capabilities. But you know, it's certainly something we're always fighting for, and it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
That's probably a good segue into development issues generally. What are the priorities of the ACC at the moment? Where are the most pressing needs in the region?
We're actually in a with the meetings we're having in Kuala Lumpur with our development team and people, the executive boards, chief executives of the test playing countries. Actually, a period of like re-examining our priorities. And you know, China was a big project the past 4 or 5 years for the ACC and the ICC. China is being re-examined to the extent that, you know, they've had a push. Now it's, let's see what they can do by themselves. And we've reached a level where we've literally identified countries like, you know, Afghanistan, Nepal, Hong Kong, Oman, and the UAE as the teams that are by ICC and ACC rankings at the top of the tree. And they should be perhaps pushed towards, given the best possible chance towards qualification for the T20 and the 50 over World Cups. Because in the old days, the game of cricket was, you know, globalization, let's get as many people playing cricket as possible. But I think now the game of cricket, what's measured the country's success is not how many are playing the game, but how well they're playing. So, you know, countries like Afghanistan certainly have impressed worldwide. Just because they've qualified for T20 World Cups, still unbeaten in first-class cricket, and all that, I think the dozen or so matches they played, and do well, of course, whenever they play against a test-playing country in 50 overs, having lost, obviously, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Australia, but done well enough to say, hey, these guys are not far away from really being a good side. So our priorities are being re-examined, and there may be more focus development activity in the countries which are most likely to succeed at global level.
So on development in general, some of the Asian countries are often criticised for fielding teams made up of expatriate players. Is there a move to encourage more locals to play in countries like the UAE and Bahrain, for example?
Yeah, Andrew, what happens is we've, at the under-16 level, we make it mandatory to have at least 3 passport holders in the playing 11. You know, just through a quirk of, you know, Haydn and Langer and Kasparovic, you know, were German and Polish migrants into Australia, and they got passports within a generation. But you can be born in the Middle East, you can be the grandson or granddaughter of someone who's been born in the Middle East, but if you're not a bloodline Arab, you don't get nationality. And that's unfortunate for these individuals who obviously pay whatever taxes there are, contribute to society. They just don't get franchised into the nation. So, and yet, with cricket having 4-year rules and 7-year rules for participants, they do get a chance to represent their country. So, you know, we understand both both sides. We'd like to obviously have Arab children playing in the Middle East, but few Arab children play any sport, and certainly cricket is not up there as the most popular. I think falconry is even popular, more popular than, you know, camel racing or things. It's just unfortunate, but, yeah. You know, given society, given culture society, it's going to be a slow process, but, you know, it'll change, I'm sure.
Just on the pushing for high performance thing, does this mean that there is a certain amount of competition between the regions, the regional development bodies, to try and push their own teams forward for funding or for whatever other reason?
You mean in terms of Asian region ACC versus EAP, East Asia Pacific and Europe and the Americas, etc.?
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, as the great thing about having ex-cricketers in the lineup in the regions, that they are competitive animals. I mean, they've had to compete against other cricketers to get into national sides and then compete as coaches to get, you know, these jobs. So the competitive element is there. In terms of funding, you know, the decisions are made by executive bodies of the ICC and ACC. At the moment, it's felt that Asia, having generated, you know, the most money in terms of the ICC sponsors, through India or Asia-based, Asia should command a greater share of development funding. That's how it's been for the past few years, and that may well continue for the near future. If it changes, I think, as I said, the game of cricket is now is measured not in how much funding you get, but in what results you you produce. So if Afghanistan, Nepal, Hong Kong, UAE, Oman continue to do well, I'm sure development funding for Asia will continue to, you know, prosper.
Beyond those five, which nations do you see doing the best work and which are most likely to come through?
You know, going back to the ethnic cricket thing, the Maldives are all Maldivian nationals. The Bhutanese are all Bhutanese nationals. It's just because obviously their economies haven't been attractive enough for migrants from the, you know, subcontinent or England or Australia or South Africa to go in there and do what they've done for Hong Kong or the UAE. So we're very impressed with the way those countries have organically developed over the past 5 or 10 years. They are a good measure of coaching and development and the way a country gets behind the sport. I think they're worth looking at. As we saw in this recent ACC 2020, Maldives beat Singapore, been playing cricket for, you know, generations. Bhutan do well up to a point. They beat, they're better than the rest of the so-called minnows, but when they come up against the, you know, the more established teams, they tend to get knocked back. But, you know, they have that desire to succeed, and they've got a lot of local support. The foreign minister is the head of the cricket board. So it's, you know, it bodes well for their future development. And, you know, as I said, they're ethnic cricketers. Malaysia's always had ethnic cricketers. There's some imported individuals now from Pakistan and Sri Lanka. But the core is Malaysian or Malay. So that's also a good success story for the future. It's just these countries need that little bit extra in terms of either access to time on the field or access to better coaching. And that's what obviously as working people they lack. But, you know, that's just a bigger picture scenario.
One of the other aspects of the ACC that is unusual at this point is that they're, I think, the only region that continues to play 50-over cricket at a regional level. That likely to remain the case, and is there a reason that they haven't followed the practice of the other regions in focusing on the T20?
Well, 50-over cricket was all that the world knew until just a few years ago, outside of multi-day cricket. 2020 cricket is certainly a great introduction for anyone new to the game. It's a great development pathway for young cricketers, anyone new to the game. But it's impossible to teach the game using 2020 alone. you know, cricket, obviously, it's, you know, it's a broad-based skill category to, you know, and you have to master so many aspects to succeed. That 50 overs is still a great, pathway to learning, you know, to really becoming a good cricketer. 50 overs is, ACC can afford to have 50 over cricket on top of 2020 because it is so well funded through its Asia Cup and its development funding. It's, I always feel it's such a waste when you've gone out onto a fresh wicket on a beautiful sunny day to only play 20 overs. If you can fit 100 overs, you know, do that. So I think, everyone's keen to keep 50 over cricket, going. It's, good for the players, good for the coaches to prove their worth at Asia Cup levels. In the past, I think until 2004 and 2006, we had our top associates, Hong Kong and the UAE, qualify through 50 over cricket to play 50 over ODIs against, the Asian, ODI countries. Under the new rights, sold in a bundle from 2007 onwards, the next Asia Cup, the associate countries were not included. But once the new rights are renegotiated with the new broadcaster, you know, what's to stop Afghanistan and one other associate coming back into the Asia Cup fold as they had been previously? You know, you can't make the leap from 20 overs to 50 overs. So 50 over cricket is still a big pathway to prove these countries' worth at, you know, 50 over World Cup level.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the Asia Cup. That's in an interesting situation now, obviously, because there's also now the Asian Games is available as a pathway for teams to play against the full members. And also, is it likely that, how likely do you think it is that they will actually allow the full members to play against the developing nations and the associate nations at the Asia Cup, having got rid of them?
At the Asia Cup, when the last, three Asia Cup cycle was negotiated, it was just before Afghanistan became an ODI nation. So Afghanistan weren't even considered then. You know, they were still climbing up the ladder. And, you know, with all due respect to Hong Kong and the UAE on the performance in 2004 and 2006, they weren't quite good enough yet at that stage to, really challenge the test playing nations. But we've seen Afghanistan give Bangladesh, Pakistan and India decent competitions across 20 overs and 50 overs, at, on a 19 level as well. So, you know, Afghanistan is certainly worthy of inclusion in future Asia Cups. Plus, on a commercial side, you know, Afghanistan TV can pay X, Y, and Z, if whoever has the rights, can pay them a fair amount for those, access to those matches. So it wouldn't be necessarily a loss-making scenario for these companies, whoever gets the rights the next Asia Cup cycle, to have Afghanistan included. They are still an ODI nation, and depending on the performance in the ICC World Cricket League, they could well be an ODI nation when the next rights are negotiated.
And with the Asian Games, how does this fit into the development?
The Asian Games was something the ACC was trying to get on board since 2004, the Doha Asian Games in 2006. It's just that happened at the time, you know, admin-wise and creating a ground of quality in the desert. It just hadn't, you know, there wasn't enough time to do it. But as we saw in Guangzhou in 2010 and in Korea, Incheon next time, 2014, it's going to happen. And what happens is that the Asian Games 2020 is different to other 2020s in terms of it's not by qualification, it's by invitation. Anyone who wants to play can play in that Asian Games. There's no barriers to entry. The only barrier being that the squad have to be passport holders of their country. Hence, the Arab countries, of course, can't yet field a team. But, you know, the ACC countries have been there. Japan's fielded a team in the women's. We look forward to working hand in hand with the Asian Games organizers certainly in the last Asian Games, the ACC provided all the technical support staff, the umpires, match referees, and all the officials. So we're all for the Asian Games.
Will the full members in the future, do you think, will they get around to fielding top string side, particularly India and Pakistan, I guess, who haven't in the past or didn't in the last?
Yeah, I mean, the last Asian Games, if people remember, it was played, the finals between Afghanistan and Bangladesh, after Afghanistan had beaten the Pakistan, who weren't obviously at their strongest. I think they were playing at series in Sri Lanka or something at the time. But that Pakistan had three, you know, internationals in their team, and Afghanistan beat them. And the Bangladesh team had Ashraful as captain, and Nasir Hussain, and a few other, you know, established international cricketers in their lineup, and Afghanistan only lost to Bangladesh in the last over. So it's not as if the test playing countries think of it as an unchallenging format. In fact, they probably think it may be too challenging. You know, if we want to lose, we'll be embarrassed into playing countries where they would, suffer defeat. So, you know, I think they would be more inclined to take it seriously than, maybe you'd be thinking. But yeah, at any level, a gold medal is a gold medal. And for the cricketers and the nations involved, it's such a rare occurrence. I mean, it was Pakistan's first ever team gold medal, or their first ever gold medal in the whole of the Asian Games history, about, 50 years, when Pakistan won the women's gold last time in Guangzhou. So, they really take it seriously.
Women's cricket's something that the Asian Federation's probably been a little bit behind on, the other ones. What's the status there? Is that improving?
Yeah, the status of women as a whole in Asia, of course, is one, ironically, where even though there have been so many female prime ministers of Asian, South Asian countries, women themselves haven't been advancing in sport and society as much as, someone from a Western viewpoint would think ideal. Russell and Andrew, it's something that we are, passionate about supporting women's cricket, women's sport. You know, we feel that a gold medal to a sporting administrator is of equal merit whether it comes from a woman or a man. Women are climbing up the ladder in Asia. Still a long way to go. Nothing that we're not putting any impediments in their way. On the contrary, we're trying to do as much as we can to get them up the highest level in cricket, let alone other sports.
Let's talk about then the World Cricket League 3, which starts in a couple of weeks. How do you think the Asian nations, Oman and Nepal, will go in that?
Yeah, well, it's they're both doing as much as they can to prepare for what are alien conditions to them. You know, Bermuda's about as far west as any of them have ever been. You know, small island, turf, lush turf. It's going to be, alien. But they're doing as much as they can to prepare. Nepal's coach, Pubudu Dasanayake, has spent time in Canada, so he's not unfamiliar with what Bermuda could be like. I think Nepal are one pace bowler, if not two, short of, having an ideal, well-balanced squad. But they are perhaps more likely than Oman to succeed. But, if we knew the results right now, we shouldn't even bother, turning up to follow it. It's going to be very open, I think, competition. I think World Cricket Leagues, historically, in the past 5-6 years, have always favoured the home team. The home teams always get to the final or win the event. And so Bermuda have to be considered as prime candidates to move up. And with them, Italy are perhaps out of season. It's hard for them to train in what's been a very harsh European winter. Nepal and Oman, we've seen them. Oman's batting hasn't quite clicked on evidence of the T20 last couple of weeks. Nepal looked likely, but let's see. Let's see. We're very hopeful Nepal gets through.
Yeah, it's certainly in the past something of a crapshoot, some of the World Cricket League. I think we saw that in number 7 just passed, that anyone can win on a day.
In a couple of weeks, we've got the under-19 Asian qualifier. Only one place available to the World Cup, because the global qualifiers have been scrapped. Who's your pick to take that place?
You know, the coaches, when I met them all in Nepal for HC 2020, they're all kind of concerned about that, because the second, you know, as you know, Andrew Nuttall, there's six going through, one from each of the five Asian regions, plus the sixth being the host, UAE. So in the past, you know, Afghanistan and Nepal have featured strongly. I've been told this year, Nepal's under-19 are more mountain boys, you know, they're quite raw and new to the game. So maybe it's so open. Afghanistan's under-19s, you know, they're pretty strong. They have a huge conveyor belt of thousands of cricketers moving forward every year, and they have plenty to choose from to make their best 15. And Afghanistan have to be favoured. But, you know, they don't play spin bowling well, because they're on turf, lush turf of Malaysia. So you never know. Malaysia themselves have Roy Dias as their coach now. Roy Dias was the guy who got Nepal up to World Cup under-19 winning, you know, plate winning level, and they beat South Africa, I think England and Pakistan in their time. So, you know, it's going to be, the coaches are going to be battling as hard as the players, I think. And it's not a crapshoot. Certainly four or five could join, could win it.
Well, talking about youth level, it's safe to say that the Asian region's had some problems with the eligibility of some youth players in the past. I think there was an under-17 tournament a while back where only two teams actually had 11 players who were under the correct age. Has that started to resolve itself now? Are teams more honest, shall we say?
Yeah, again, honest is a fair word. But honest in terms of, I think, you know, Afghanistan had their problems in terms of just registering births, in an alien country in refugee camps. So when they went back to Afghanistan, it's hard to know how old they exactly were. In Nepal, they measure by moons, you know, certainly the mountain regions. They don't actually come down to Kathmandu and say, my child is born on the 4th of March. So and so. But, we instigated a bone verification thing. So what you had is what we didn't want to see is giant children of, you know, 6 foot plus playing against 4.5 foot kids and literally knocking their heads off. Because we have a responsibility, when it comes to youth cricket, we have to kind of be guardians of them, of these cricketers, when they're away from their parents. So we wanted to level the playing field by having kids of roughly equal physical dimensions playing. So we introduced bone scans and MRIs and so forth to get physically matched cricketers of a certain, you know, of a type on the field so they could play, you know, fair competitive cricket. That happened, what, about 5-6 years ago? And since then, mm-hmm. The countries have been happily following all the guidelines and protocols in terms of getting their players scanned and measured. And obviously, once the player is measured at a certain age, when he's 15, you kind of know he's going to be in four years' time. So that batch is, it's been fine. We've encountered no problems since then.
Great.
Thanks, Harry. That was really good.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks, guys. You put on a good show, and it's always a pleasure to tune in.
Oh, right. Thanks very much.
And thanks for all your missionary work in promoting this level of cricket.